Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Don't look now, but there's another Greek rescue plan out there. What they're actually saying down at Occupy Wall Street, and what we think we know but really don't about the environment. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, conference calls that give you clarity, professionalism, and flexibility all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, today the 10th of October. Great to have you with us. This is Columbus Day, when we give the bond markets a day off to celebrate a European who, the history books tell us, discovered America. I, however, would be willing to bet that a lot of people in the bond markets wish they'd never heard of Europe right about now, especially a country down in the southeast corner that's all but certain to default on its debts. Greece is, at best, unlikely to be able to pay back the bonds it owes. So amid all the back and forth over there now about how to maybe save Athens, the real negotiating is about how to let Greece default without creating a panic. There's an idea being talked about that the experts like to call ring fencing. It's antiseptic, I know, but Europe's got high hopes for it. Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore explains how it's supposed to work.
The last thing European leaders want is for Greece to suddenly shrug one day and say that it can't pay the interest on its bonds. They worry that all hell would break loose in financial markets. So the solution is an orderly default. Kathy Jones, a fixed income strategist at Schwab, explained to me how this works. It's basically paying less money over more time to allow Greece to catch up with its bills.
I think the orderly default for Greece would look like this. If you're holding a two-year bond, then you might have to take 50 cents on the dollar, and then instead of being a two-year bond, it's now a 10-year bond.
Once Europe singles out Greece for an orderly default, they'll put it behind a ring fence. It's kind of like a scaffolding, an announcement that Greece's bailout is now under construction. And what happens behind the scaffolding? Imagine a little crew of financial handymen. Instead of sculpting friezes on the Parthenon, they're carving up Greek bonds into a more manageable size. But there's only one problem. Anyone who owns the bonds of Italy and Spain is close enough to look over the Greek scaffolding and see the mess and start worrying. Thomas Schmuel heads the international practice for the law firm Duane Morris.
The concept of debt has implicit in it the possibility that it might not get paid. If you hear that a Greek sovereign debt is not being paid, then you have to worry about the sovereign debt that you hold from another country.
In other words, while a ring fence and orderly default are the best chances Europe has of preventing a panic, they're not foolproof. The 17 Eurozone countries also need to agree on a big bailout fund to be ready to back up its countries and their banks. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
This was a banner day for two American economists. Thomas Sargent of New York University and Christopher Sims of Princeton were awarded the Nobel Prize in the Dismal Science Day for giving us ways to answer this question. How do you know what economic policies are going to do to the economy? What effect do things like deficit spending and interest rates and tax cuts actually have? The answer is, at times, technical, as economics tends to be, and at once very human, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
Thomas Sargent and Christopher Sims help economists predict the outcome of economic policies. Chris Christopher is a senior economist at IHS Global Insight. He uses Sims's statistical models all the time.
If we're going to propose a policy, what will be the effect of that policy? And these two gentlemen offered techniques by which you can study these things.
At a press conference at Princeton University today, Sims says statistics and data from the past are critical to helping us
project the effects of policy.
His colleague Thomas Sargent has gained notoriety for his work on the rational expectations theory. Sargent explains it this way.
It's an assumption that people basically understand what's going on, and you can't fool them.
In other words, people are rational and react predictably to economic policies. Lawrence White is an economist at the NYU Stern School of Business and a colleague of Thomas Sargent's. He says, for instance, if the government runs up a big deficit, you and I might spend less.
Participants in the economy anticipate that they are going to be taxed in the future to pay back the debt, and this causes them to save more today.
White says you can see the theory at work in the way the Federal Reserve has reacted to the down economy, making a lot of noise about how it's going to keep interest rates low for years.
Which ought to reassure current participants that they could borrow, they could invest, they could expand their businesses.
At least in theory. The two Nobel winners are teaching a class together at Princeton, but they don't always agree. Thomas Sargent says he and Sims often vet each other's papers, and the critiques can be rigorous.
I have a large set of his comments on my papers, and they start like this. This paper is deeply flawed.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We're going to pause for a second in the broadcast right now and ask you a question. You ever done something you regret? Something that even at the time you figured might not be the greatest idea? Yeah, we all have. But it's not often our miscalculations cost our companies billions of dollars. A couple of weeks ago, Netflix founder Reed Hastings said he was going to split the company's DVD and streaming video business into two parts and create a separate DVD-only company called Quixtar. Customers went nuts. They bolted by the hundreds of thousands. Wall Street went nuts, shredded the stock. So today the company announced a do-over, or rather an un-do-over, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins explains.
Quixtar is dead. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings says the company's DVD and video streaming business will remain under one roof. No separate websites, no separate bills. Lazard Capital Markets analyst Barton Crockett says there's a good reason for this.
Consumers rejected it. They ridiculed it. Reed Hastings heard. He's retreated. He's made the right choice, which is to give up a bad idea.
This is how Saturday Night Live portrayed the idea online.
Here's what's new with Quixtar. We've merged with Aflac to make Quaxtar. Just so you can get your insurance coverage and Commodore 64 game.
Tony Weibel is an analyst with Janney Capital Markets. He says, split or no split, Netflix is in trouble.
Frankly, it seems like they're acting out of desperation, in part because I think the world around them is changing very quickly.
And he says the company is paying out a lot for TV shows and movie streaming deals with the entertainment industry. That's a threat to profits from its streaming business, and the DVD business is sure to slump as more content becomes available online. What Netflix has going for it is over 20 million subscribers and a strong brand.
And both of those things are in jeopardy right now.
Netflix also announced it was boosting prices a few months back. Some analysts estimate it may have lost around 10% of its subscribers since then. And while Quixtar may be gone, the price hike remains. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, promises of a Greek ring fence and a plan to backstop European banks gave traders a boost, and then a broad rally took the major indices the rest of the way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our Friday regular John Carney from CNBC had an idea the other day. He's in New York, and he's a reporter, so he figured, why not just go down and camp out along with the Occupy Wall Street crowd, see what's really going on. He even set up something of a speaker's corner, an open mic kind of thing for those with something to say.
My name's Bruce. I'm a professor at City College. I'm here for the same reason everyone else, to demonstrate against corporate greed.
My name's Harry Braun. I'm a Democratic presidential candidate against President Obama.
Hello, my name is David Intrader. I'm a businessman here in New York, and I'm here for a number of reasons. First of all, I'm here because I love America, and I want us to restore our democracy.
You can find more at CNBC.com. For now, though, John Carney himself down in Lower Manhattan. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing great, Kai.
So how was your night last night, man?
It was long and late, but, you know, there's a lot of people here to keep you company in the park.
Well, tell me about it. What's it like?
It's got a little bit of a festival atmosphere. A lot of people hanging out. There's drums on both sides of the park today. So there's a constant drum beat wherever you are. It feels a little bit like you might be in the parking lot for a Phish concert.
What are you learning, John? I mean, with the speaker's corner you guys set up and the amount of time you've been spending down there, what's the story they're telling?
A lot of the complaints are actually very mainstream when you come down to it. It's people, you know, talking about things we talk about all the time, the economy, jobs, and debt. A lot of the young people here say, look, I graduated college, I've got $80,000 in student loans, and I can't find a job. This isn't the deal that I was told I would get. And, you know, they feel shut out. There's also a lot of complaints about whether we have politics that's responsive to people's needs these days.
Yeah. They are getting a lot more attention than they did even a week or two ago. Do they think that the people you're talking to down there on Wall Street, do they think this is going to go anywhere and they're going to get satisfaction?
They do think that it's going to keep growing, and they've been right. When I was here a week ago, there was probably half as many people as there are today. It's Columbus Day. It's a holiday, so maybe that's helped people show up, but there's a ton of people here. We couldn't barely find room just to, you know, sit down with a microphone and have this conversation right now.
Is there a sense of anger or is it frustration? And I know that's kind of a fine line.
It's not as angry as I thought it would be. There's frustration, but the people here are walking around with smiles on their face. I think they think that they're accomplishing something just by raising awareness to, you know, their presence here. And so they're pretty happy, actually.
So you've been doing this for a long time, John, covering Wall Street. And I'd be curious as to your take on why this is happening now. Why this moment in time?
The anger that might have erupted a couple of years ago was delayed in part by the election of Barack Obama. That filled people with hope. It made them think that something would change. But, you know, as the years passed, the economy didn't improve. They didn't feel like the government became more responsive. And so I think that was the final straw that broke the camel's back was, as the economy started to tank again this summer, people, you know, got fed up and decided that they were going to take to the parks.
And what about you? I mean, it's not every day you go out and spend the night on the streets. I mean, why are you there?
For me, this is a totally different kind of story. I'm used to talking to guys who work for investment banks, talking to big businesses. And I get to now hang out in a park and talk to totally different people. This is great for me.
John Carney. He's a regular on our Friday weekly wrap. His day job is running the blog NetNet at CNBC.com. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Adrian Hill came into my office this morning and said, "Hey, listen, I need you to quote Donald Rumsfeld when you set up my story on the show this afternoon." And I said, "Okay, how come?" And she said, "Because it really tees up where Americans are on the environment right now." So, loosely quoted, it goes like this. When it comes to our knowledge of and attitudes about the environment, there are known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. Here's Adrian.
First, the known knowns. When it comes to the environment, Americans pretty much think they got it down.
In 2011, 7 in 10 said they knew a lot or a fair amount about environmental issues and problems.
Timothy Kenyon is a researcher with GfK Roper. He headed up a consumer attitude study for SC Johnson, the cleaning products company. He looked at environmental attitudes over the last two decades and found a giant known unknown. Fewer people actually know what they can do to help the environment in big ways. Not surprising, says Stanford professor John Krosnick.
The change is that in recent years, climate change has become the focus.
And climate change is a big problem with no easy solutions. Talk of reducing future pollution now, well,
it's somewhat like saying to a cancer patient, "Now the bad news is you've got cancer, and it's a very, very serious problem. The good news is we can prevent you from getting more cancer."
But that known unknown hasn't stopped Americans from making small changes. More people recycle now, more people buy green products, more people take public transit, which leads directly to the unknown unknowns. Consumers often overestimate the effects of small actions. And, says Oklahoma professor Riley Dunlap, there may be too much focus on those types of changes in the first place.
Many times the solution to problems is not to ask individuals to change their behaviors, but to ask individuals to support legislation and policies.
Now you know. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, the service that gives clarity, professionalism, and flexibility for conference calls at a low price. Vast provides both regular and toll-free numbers so you can set up calls anytime and provides web tools to manage or record calls instantly. Priced at 2.5 cents per minute with no commitments or contracts, try Vast Conference with two free calls at vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace. That's vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
Coming up, small town America just trying to hang on.
A community that was very affluent and sort of plugged in and cultural. The things that were supporting that community are suddenly gone.
But first, let's do the numbers. My, oh my, the Dow Industrials added 330 points today, nearly 3%, ended at 11,433 on a European pledge to strengthen the banks over there. The NASDAQ moved up 86 points, 3.5%. Ended at 2566. The S&P 500 swelled 39 points, 3.4%. Finished at 1194. Bank of America strengthened 6.5% today. J.P. Morgan Chase rang up more than 5%. Apple up 5%. It was reported that more than a million people have ordered the new iPhone 4S. Netflix dimmed 4.75% today on the news we told you about. Yahoo captured more than 2% on rumors that founder Jerry Yang might organize a company buyout with private equity investors. The bond market, as we mentioned, was closed today. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. President Obama visits the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local No. 5 Training Center in Pittsburgh. He'll tour the training facilities. In Washington, the American National Standards Institute hosts World Standards Week. The conference opens tomorrow. And Saturday Night Live premiered live from New York on October 11, 1975. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was yet another story today that forces one to ask this question. Recovery? What recovery? A study based on some recent census numbers says household incomes have fallen more since the recession ended than they did during the recession. And how well you did economically may depend on your education level. But beware, this is one of those stories that comes with a twist. From our education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
In the 2 years since the recession technically ended in June 2009, median household income fell more than 6.5%, counting inflation. That's more than twice the decline during the recession. John Coder with Centier Research is one of the report's authors.
As consumer prices have started to increase a little bit faster, you end up with a decline in purchasing power.
Millions of people being out of work much longer also knocked down income. Not surprisingly, people with a bachelor's degree or higher fared better than those with less education. But here's what is surprising. People with just a few years of college, a 2-year associate's degree, saw their income decline more than 11% since the recession ended, more than twice as much as someone who didn't even finish high school.
The reason people who haven't finished high school don't get hit quite so hard is because they don't have as far to fall. Their earnings are fairly stable, whether there's a recession or not.
Anthony Carnevali directs Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce. He says a lot of people get associate's degrees in general education, hoping to transfer to a 4-year college.
But most of them don't end up getting the bachelor's degree.
So they're not prepared for any specific job. Then again, he says people who have an associate's degree with a career focus, like healthcare or engineering technicians, have fared better than the average person with a bachelor's. It all depends on what you study. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Whatever degree you have on your resume, associate's, bachelor's, or more, they probably have one thing in common. They didn't come cheap. Student loan debt in this country now exceeds the amount we collectively owe on all of our credit cards. Best guesses are it's going to hit $1 trillion by the end of the year. And perhaps not coincidentally, that's one of the things the Occupy Wall Street protesters have been protesting. There's even a petition circulating that asks Uncle Sam to forgive student debt. More than 400,000 people have signed it. Commentator Justin Wolfers not being one of them.
There's an argument going around that forgiving the country's student loan debt will stimulate the economy. The basic argument is this. The president signs a bill, and millions of Americans would suddenly have hundreds or even thousands of extra dollars each month. Consumer spending increases, and then businesses will start hiring again. Sounds promising. But here's the thing. If government money is to be just given away, why on earth would we give it to college grads? On average, they're richer than most. and they're suffering the least during the recession. Plus, if you spend money for stimulus, you want to get a big bang for your buck. But forgiving $50,000 worth of debt is not ideal. It's an expensive way to get these folks to spend the few hundred dollars that currently goes to loan repayment. Much better to give 50 poor people $1,000 each. That money will be spent much more rapidly. And think about the incentives. If we give one generation a free trip through college, what will happen during the next recession? I reckon the next generation will feel entitled to the same privilege and they'll lobby to get it. So we'll end up with more spending in the least productive part of our economy, the lobbying industry. I know that my arguments won't be convincing to those of you struggling under mountains of debt. They'll say, bail us out, not the millionaires, billionaires, and corporations. But this isn't the choice we face. Economists talk about opportunity cost. It's a principle that says you should compare your choice with the best alternative. Relieving student loans may be a better idea than more tax cuts for the rich. But is it better than providing stimulus to the 1 in 7 Americans currently living in poverty? My conclusion? Yes, let's stimulate the economy. But let's do so in a way that serves the greater good rather than just ourselves.
Justin Wolfers teaches public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. If you've got a comment, please do send it along. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says contact. The census data that Amy Scott was telling us about a moment ago is a treasure trove of trends and tendencies in this country. Falling wealth is one. Here's another one. Cities and suburbs are growing faster than ever, and small towns are shrinking. They've had the same set of problems for decades, those towns have. Young people leaving because the jobs have left as well. But just because something's a trend doesn't mean it can't change. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk and Small Town Iowa, Eve Troe reports.
About 15,000 people live in Newton, Iowa. Been the same for a decade. Which is surprising, since Newton lost more than 4,000 jobs. In 2007, before the recession, its patron company, Maytag, went under.
You know, that's the trouble with you Maytag washers and dryers. You're too dependable. It's not often that anybody needs us Maytag repairmen. That's why we're the loneliest guys in town.
And Newton is still lonely for Maytag. The company was the town for over 100 years. Newton's head of economic development, Frank Liebel, shows me the company's legacy. Maytag Park, Maytag Pool, Maytag Auditorium.
That failed in a couple of bond issues, and all of a sudden Maytag says, well, I'll tell you what, we'll pledge X amount of dollars if the community can go out and raise the rest, and just like that, it passed.
That go-to partner is gone. But Liebel says the industrial legacy is still here and still has value. Buildings for manufacturing, loyal, well-trained workers. When Maytag closed, the local news showed them tying their boots to the factory fence.
You hire a Maytagger, and you'll hire somebody who'll work. That's what I'm proud of.
Lots of Maytaggers are proud of Newton, too. They wanted to stay. So Liebel says now they commute to wherever there's work.
I'm not going to sell my house. I'm not going to move away. I'm going to find a job 30 miles down the road in Des Moines.
Des Moines. Newton always saw that big city as a threat to local business. Now it wants to partner up and get some economic runoff.
People today look at Des Moines as being an asset instead of being detrimental. The four-bedroom community, so what? That's wonderful.
Wealthy Des Moines families bought many Maytag executives' homes. Newton's pushing its good schools and safe streets as an alternative to city life. Joe Benesch grew up in Newton. He moved back this year after working as an architect in Chicago and Miami. He wanted to raise a family the way he was raised.
In a community that was very affluent and sort of plugged in and cultural.
He wants to keep Newton thinking big, not resign itself to being a suburb.
I fear that sort of contraction as a thought process because, you know, it's like we're not going to be Newton anymore. We're going to be different. Things are going to be different.
He's become a big hometown booster. But towns like Newton can't count on high flyers like Benesch returning to the nest, says sociologist Richard Florida. He's the author of books like Rise of the Creative Class and Who's Your City?
A community will never win an economic development race by trying to bring back the people it left.
He says at age 25, highly educated workers are more likely to move away from small towns than move back. By age 35, they're three times less likely to return.
The places that are successful offer something for the people who grew up there, and they offer something for new people.
It takes at least one generation to turn around a town, he says. Newton is working on the new. Two wind power companies moved in and hired 1,000 workers. A NASCAR speedway hopes to lure tourists. And while more local kids leave for university, never to return, high school students can now also train for careers that lead to local jobs. In an old Maytag facility, they study to be nurses' aides, caterers.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to light it.
Or welders.
When you're lighting this, don't have it turned.
George Keith Simpson teaches welding at the community college. A class of high school juniors spends 2 hours a day with him. They want to work after graduation.
2 years in high school, then one summer, then ready to go to the workforce. Welders are retiring faster than we can train them. There's a waiting list for the students as soon as they finish the program.
Newton, Iowa doesn't expect a corporate patron to take Maytag's place. It wants to lure smaller, more diverse companies. And its best asset right now may be its reputation as a town with good schools and nice homes that workers are happy to drive back to at the end of the day. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, Dateline Toledo, Ohio. You remember Joe the Plumber from John McCain's 2008 campaign, the voice of the disaffected middle class? Turns out he now wants into the political machine. Joe Wurzelbacher filed a statement of candidacy with the Federal Election Commission last week. We checked. There are lots of lawyers and farmers, medical types and scientists in the 111th Congress. That's the one that's sitting right now. No plumbers, though, yet. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Monday. Today, the Dow added 330 points, nearly 3% on some European news. The Nasdaq moved up 86 points, 3.5%. The S&P 500 swelled 39 points, about 3.4% there. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, economic indicators in unusual places.
The owners have either been evicted or left the home with no intention of returning to care for those animals.
Our series, Economy 4.0, returns. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.